Call to order a meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Monday, March 12, 2007. Just to roadmap how we're going to proceed today, we have a couple of work sessions, but I'm going to set those over until after the public hearings because we have some people who've traveled in from a distance to for bills that are being heard today, and we'll take them in the order in which they appear on the agenda. House Bills 2741, then 2766, and then 2782. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2741. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2741 relates to investigations. ORS Chapter 146 gives district attorneys and or medical examiners responsibility to investigate all human deaths. Within this investigative authority is the power to control a crime scene, in large part to ensure the preservation of any relevant evidence. In cases where there is a physical injury but no death, present law gives only the medical examiner, and not the district attorney, the authority to investigate. Only if the injury occurred under, quote, suspicious or unknown circumstances and involved a knife or gun. House Bill 2741 addresses two perceived problems with present law. First of all, it allows the district attorney or the medical examiner to conduct injury investigations, those that fall short of death. The concern is that if a crime occurred, there is likely evidence that should be preserved in injury cases, just as there is in cases that result in death. The second perceived problem that House Bill 2741 addresses is that existing law is not broad enough to cover all suspicious injuries. Many crimes or assaults happen through the use of items that are not technically deadly weapons, hands, rocks, pipes, screwdrivers, etc. House Bill 2741 broadens the scope of ORS 146.710 to include any and all such circumstances.
Okay, we have one witness signed up, Chuck Sparks. Mr. Sparks.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. I'm Chuck Sparks. I'm a senior deputy district attorney with Multnomah County. And I supervise our team that prosecutes robberies and arsons, burglaries, vehicular homicides, and firearms violations and the like. I'm here to answer questions, hopefully. You've got a one-page summary of our concerns about this current law, and Mr. Stanford very ably summarized the perceived issues that these changes would address. Basically, when we get to a scene where somebody is seriously hurt, often we don't know that there's a crime. There may be a crime or there may not be a crime. And currently, if the district attorney wants to investigate, we have to, under statute, we would have to defer to the medical examiner. And the medical examiner would actually, theoretically, be charged with that investigation. And to my knowledge, that doesn't happen. And medical examiners can't conduct criminal investigations. Second, the types of injuries that even the medical examiner can investigate include only those inflicted by a very narrow category of weapons, knives, guns, or other deadly weapons. And deadly weapons is a very limited definition under Oregon law. So we're seeking to investigate unexplained or suspicious injuries in the more broad and frankly more relevant category, which is basically anything that comes to hand when people sometimes inflict harm upon each other. This expanded authority would allow us to deal with situations where someone is seriously hurt. We don't know how they've been hurt. It may be criminal, it may not be, but we can at least take a crime scene and sort of set up a crime scene and stabilize things, and then if whoever's in charge of the premises doesn't want us there, we can go to a judge, and a judge has to agree with us that this is a suspicious or unknown injury that should be investigated. The judge then can give us authorization. When I say us, I mean the district attorney and law enforcement give us the ability to then find out what's happening. And a couple of examples that might be relevant, you could have a person who is admitted into the trauma system with significant blunt force head trauma that came out of some sort of a fight. Well, we want to be able to investigate. We don't know the circumstances because the person can't tell us about it. They're unconscious or comatose. And it may be that that person was the aggressor. It may be that that person was the victim. We don't have probable cause at that point. We don't have any authorization to go in there and say, interview people, find evidence and seize evidence. This would give us the right to go to a judge if we were refused permission by, let's assume it was a homeowner or a business owner, let's say it was a bar. We could then go and ask a judge, swear out an affidavit, show the judge that there is reason to believe this is a suspicious or unexplained injury that needs to be investigated further, and then at that point either rule in or out the potential for actual criminal activity. Another example would be you have a person who's a caregiver for somebody who is elderly, somebody in their 80s or their 90s, let's say, and that elderly person is not able to communicate successfully, but they have now fallen down the stairs, according to the story, for the third time in the last 8 months. We, at that point, of course, would be concerned about that, particularly if there were significant injuries that resulted, and this change would allow the district attorney to do the investigation as opposed to the medical examiner, not as opposed to, but if the medical examiner wanted to investigate in some fashion, they would retain their statutory authority, but we, the district attorney and law enforcement would be added, and we would then have the ability to go to the home and maybe it's a live-in caregiver who has some privacy interest in the victim's home, so we couldn't just walk in and, you know, with the victim's permission or family's permission, we would have to be careful not to intrude upon the privacy interest of that caregiver, but there may be some very important evidence there of elder abuse. And that would allow us to apply to a judge if the person said no, or maybe just to apply to a judge directly, seeking authority to go in and investigate the circumstances. And maybe it really was an accident, and to the best of our ability, we would attempt to determine that. Maybe not.
Thank you, Mr. Sparks. Are there questions from the committee? Let me just make sure I have understand the background more fully. What causes either the medical examiner or the district attorney to get involved when there's just some kind of trauma has occurred and it's not clear what the circumstances of it are? It could have been accidental. Maybe it's worse than that. Is it the emergency medical personnel, or is there? And what's sort of the chain of communication? Is there a police officer summoned by emergency medical responders if there's a trauma that looks like it could conceivably have a criminal dimension to it?
Well, Chair McPherson and members of the committee, the manner in which it's reported can take several forms. Under, pardon me for a minute while I, under ORS 146750, physicians may report these injuries to the medical examiner. But often it would come from concerned relatives of the person who was hurt. It would come from suspicious neighbors, perhaps, and sometimes that's good information and sometimes it's not. Sometimes people's suspicions are true and valid, and other times they're not. But it would allow us to, we would have to draw our own conclusion that this was a suspicious or unexplained injury. And once the district attorney had made that decision that this does need to be investigated further, then we could conduct that investigation if the subject, if the people we were investigating or the situation we were investigating did not involve cooperation, then we could apply to a judge under ORS 146107. We would have the authority to enter and secure the premises, but we would have to apply for a judicial basically a warrant where the judge permits us to remain there and actually conduct an investigation.
Mr. Chair, that would mostly be after the fact, because if the police were called originally, then that would be a whole different situation. This is one where you kind of get the information later, where a doctor may suspect something, and the important part is gathering the evidence, to securing evidence that could be used, that if it's not there, it would be very difficult to prove some of those cases later on.
So generally, this wouldn't be involving the scene of the event, at the time of the event.
Right.
It's really securing, it's in authorizing the district attorney to participate in an investigation at a time when there may still be evidence that can be gathered from the various sources that were there at the scene.
Yes.
I would, Chair McPherson and members of the committee, I would add just a little bit to that. It can authorize us to go at that time to the scene. An example is the trauma system now saves a lot of people, sometimes for just a little while, sometimes for a long period of time. I think in my written testimony I refer to the fact that people who might have otherwise, to be blunt, died at the scene, and then we would have proceeded under Chapter 146 directly, the death investigation statute, are saved by the trauma system. Life Flight comes and takes them to Emmanuel, and Emmanuel works their usual
miracles.
Yeah. Or OHSU pulls the irons or the chestnuts out of the fire, and you've got somebody who's actually going to live, maybe with a very reduced quality of life, but they were a near murder victim. And you don't know at the time it happens. When you roll up on the scene, it might be at 2 a.m, you don't know how things happened. And you don't know that you have a crime or not. And so it would allow us to attempt to further what ultimately a day or two or a week or two later be a murder investigation. So, Chair McPherson, you're correct that there are times when we will find out about something after the fact and go back and attempt to preserve evidence. At other times, we'll have an ambiguous situation where somebody may well have been criminally harmed, but the trauma system prevents, thankfully, the death from occurring. And so we may end up with somebody who is very seriously harmed for life. We may end up with somebody who nearly dies but then recovers, or we may end up with somebody who dies, days or weeks later. And this allows us to, and I need to correct something I said earlier. Earlier, I believe I said we could enter before having the judicial authority to do so. I've double-checked 107, 146, 107, and we would actually have to ask for entry. We could seize the premises if given permission, but if refused permission, we have to go to a judge and make our case to the judge and say, Judge, this is a suspicious or unexplained death under Chapter 146, and we would like your authority to continue investigating, and we have to have reasonable cause.
And the medical examiner is the party who has the existing authority, and I'm just flipping back the definitions here in ORS Chapter 146, looking at just to trace through and see who that is. But that's not somebody who's in the same chain of command with the DA's office. It's somebody who's independent of the DA function, right?
The appointed medical examiner is obviously different than the district attorney. Now, in Multnomah County, and I'm not fully prepared to address the exact relationship, but the medical examiner's office, to some degree, comes under the supervision of the district attorney. And this was a recent development, and I don't believe it's true statewide. It may be more budgetary than otherwise, but tell the members of the committee that the medical examiner, while they do come and collect the body at crime scenes, do not affirmatively conduct investigations, injury investigations or otherwise. They don't have the ability to work with law enforcement to go out and to set up a crime scene and gather evidence and then ultimately rule crime out or rule crime in, and if it is a crime, to proceed accordingly. They don't obviously have the authority to go to the grand jury and obtain an indictment if that's appropriate in the grand jury's mind.
Okay. Any further questions? Mr. Sparks, I think this committee's gotten all the input it needs. Then let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2741, and I will open a work session on House Bill 2741.
The chair and the committee.
Thank you. Committee, this looks like it's a pretty narrow bill, and it's really and its main impact, it appears to me, would be for those situations where the medical examiner doesn't report directly to the district attorney, and it gives them an independent authority to participate in an investigation where there's an indication that there might have been criminal activity involved, and when there's serious injury or death.
Can I ask if the medical examiners had any input or comment of their? We didn't get any.
I would expect they wouldn't. I mean, these are things where somebody hasn't died. I was trying to remember back one time I had the medical examiner when I was working homicide call and ask for a team to go out. There had been a suicide where a man had hung himself, reportedly. The first officer there had cut him down and they'd been taken to the morgue. And the medical examiner thought it was suspicious because the guy had some other injuries that didn't look like would result from just hanging. So we went out and investigated and found that actually what had happened, the guy hung himself in these thorn bushes. And the way he did it was he tied rope and then turned around and around and around and around until he... But anyway, he got all scratched up in the process of doing that. And so it looked like something else had happened to him. But we were able, by going back and finding evidence, but that was in a short period of time. But that's the kind of thing where somebody needs to take a quick look at things, or a week or two later, if it had rained, all that evidence would have been gone pretty much. So,
thank you.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2741 be moved to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2741 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Tom?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisner?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. House Bill 2741 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Barker, I know we have you loaded up fairly heavily, but it is your bill if you carry it.
I'd be glad to. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you very much. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2741. Is he on his way now?
They said he was testifying, but he was going down to Gadding.
Okay. We'll open a public hearing on 2782. We'll return to 2766 when Representative Lim gets here, but let's open the public hearing on House Bill 2782. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2782 relates to precursor substances. ORS 475.940 to 475.980 discuss precursor substances and related offenses. Generally, precursor substances refers to chemicals needed to manufacture methamphetamine. ORS 475.940 identifies over 40 specific precursor substances, including pseudoephedrine, red phosphorus, some forms of iodine. ORS 475.950 makes the failure to report certain precursor substance transactions in the proper manner to the Oregon State Police a Class A misdemeanor. There's presently a list of 8 exceptions to this reporting requirement at ORS 475.950 sub 2. House Bill 2782 adds a 9th exception for persons who sell or transfer an isomer of a precursor substance unless it is an optical isomer. Generally, an isomer refers to a chemical species with the same number and types of atoms as another chemical species, but possessing different properties. An optical isomer refers to chemical species that are mirror images of one another. And I'm not going to say anything else.
We are honored to have Rob Bovet here to present on this bill. Mr. Bovet.
And if we could maybe ring up Lieutenant Mike Dingman from the State Police.
Very good, Mr. Dingman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Bovet. I'm wearing my hat as legal counsel for the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association. And I'll try to keep this brief. And if you really want me to go deep into organic chemistry, I happen to love it, but that makes me a certifiable weirdo. So I'll try to keep it at 50,000-foot level, but I'd love to go down to 10,000 feet with you. I'll try to explain it this way, in terms of optical isomers and isomers. Pretend for a moment that my hand, my left hand, is a molecule, is a precursor molecule. It's got a nice benzene ring and a bunch of atoms stuck on it. And pretend for a moment that it is a precursor to the drug, my hand without a thumb. So you get rid of my thumb and you got a controlled substance. Now pretend for a moment that my right hand is also a precursor substance, and if you eliminate the thumb, it creates the same controlled substance. Those are what we call optical isomers, essentially mirror images of each other. So we're very concerned about the left hand and the right hand because they both convert to that controlled substance. Now, to take it to the extreme, pretend that I have a hand, a weird hand, that has all of my fingers. Two of my fingers are attached to my palm and two of them are attached to the back of my hand. Weird looking hand. And if you eliminate the thumb off that funky looking hand, you don't get the controlled substance. But technically, that is an isomer of my left hand because it has the same chemical configuration, just arranged in a different manner. When we and when the federal government originally started drafting precursor statutes and defined which ones needed to be regulated in various means, we tended to treat all isomers the same. But there are some strange isomers out there that really we're not concerned about that are not optical isomers of precursors. And so a few years ago, the federal government cleaned up their precursor statutes and identified or confined the reporting requirements to optical isomers, and we are proposing to do the same. I have to give credit to the Hewlett-Packard scientists who have, I think, maybe a little too much time because they identified a whole series of essentially printer ink type chemicals that are technically isomers of some of our reporting required precursors. And they came to Lieutenant Dingham and said, well, do you really want us to report all these transactions for these really weird chemistry? And of course, Lieutenant Dingham and I said, no, please don't flood the OSP fax machines with all these precursor transactions about printer ink. And so we agreed, and we have agreed tentatively or temporarily to interpret the statute for OSP purposes as being limited to optical isomers, but we did promise them, and I have created and drafted for your consideration House Bill 2782 that would do just that. It would limit those precursors that are required to be reported to the isomers and the optical isomers. And so that's my short explanation. I did, however, think I should probably take the opportunity, because this is the first session in as many sessions as I can remember when I didn't have a bill before you to do substantive changes to the precursor statutes. And I think maybe just a brief word of explanation. The reason I don't have anything to ask for on precursor control is because you went as far as we asked you to go last session. It's had tremendous results. And based on our analysis of the remaining meth labs in the state of Oregon, we can't logically ask you to go any further because it accomplished exactly what it needed to accomplish. I provided you kind of an explanation of what has happened on the backside of my testimony. Since 2005, in terms of the remaining meth labs, the source of the pseudoephedrine and ephedrine for those, and I've also provided you an updated list of the meth lab incidents in the state of Oregon, and as you can see from that list, what you enacted in 2005 has had not only the anticipated results, but frankly, results beyond that which we could have expected. We have effectively nearly eliminated meth labs in the state of Oregon as a result of the action, the strong action you took in 2005. I will tell you that we have analyzed the source of the pseudoephedrine for the remaining handful of meth labs, and as it turns out, as I report in the blue colored font there on page 2, most of those remaining meth lab incidents are just simply the discovery of old dump sites and old incidents where you've got boxes of the old chemicals. The handful, literally the six since we've had since July 1st, the six that we've had, we've identified where the pseudoephedrine came from, and basically those were bleed outs from pre-existing situations or before we got the Congress to enact the Combat Methamphetamine Epidemic Act. So really, at this point in time, for the first time, as I mentioned before, in a long time, we're not asking for further precursor controls. Now, something could develop tomorrow, and we could be running back to you next session. But at this point in time, what you did in 2005 has had, frankly, amazing success, and is being looked at and is being modeled by not only the federal government, who's currently conducting a study on what has been happening in the various states, but if you weren't already aware, in November, the Drug Czar's office published a report that not only identified Oregon as having gone the furthest, but identified Oregon as having had the deepest reduction in meth labs in the nation, and we are being looked at very seriously by a number of neighboring states, including Nevada, who just printed a bill to move pseudoephedrine to Schedule 3. So thought I'd just throw all that stuff in because we don't have a substantive precursor bill, but if you'd love to hear more about optical isomers and isomers and organic chemistry, I'm all in for it, but I think probably the audience probably isn't.
Well, we do love hearing about the reduction of meth labs. I'm not sure that more about isomers. Very entertaining. Should we hear from Mr. Dingman and then open up for questions?
Chairman McPherson and members of the committee, I'm Mike Dingman. I'm a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police, and I oversee our drug enforcement section. And I think Rob accurately described what we were looking at, and I'm just here in the event that you have any questions that Rob can't answer that maybe I would be able to answer.
Okay. Mr. Brobet, make sure that I understand and then the committee understands more broadly. So we have a system for reporting transactions in precursor substances, which I know you've said this already, but it's helpful maybe for the committee to understand. These are the various chemical components that are necessary in order to convert raw material into meth. Or is it aimed only at meth, or are there other kinds of drug processes that would be implicated here by the precursor statute?
Mr. Chair, actually that laundry list of 40, only a handful of those involve conversion to meth. It regulates precursors for a variety of controlled substances. And actually, the precursors we're talking about primarily here are not ones used in meth so much, although a couple of them are. Of those 40 precursors, we regulate them in various ways, and only a smaller number of them we actually require reporting. For example, pseudoephedrine, one we've focused on, isn't a reporting one. It's a controlled in a different manner. So we're talking about a smaller number, I think it's about 30-plus, that we actually have a reporting requirement for, and it's those that we're focusing on essentially confining to the optical isomers of those precursors.
Mm-hmm. And without this, the change that's proposed here in House Bill 2782, then we have certain precursor transactions that are required to be reported, subject to a penalty of being a misdemeanor if they're not reported. And in fact, they are not things we need to track. They're not. They would not be. They would arise in innocent circumstances and wouldn't indicate somebody was manufacturing a controlled substance. Is that right,
Mr. Chair? That's exactly correct.
Yeah. And I assume that what's happening now is law enforcement isn't enforcing this requirement because it doesn't make any sense to, but what this bill would do is would align our criminal justice statutes with actual practice.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly correct.
Right. Okay. Representative Flores.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Blavatt, thank you, and I really do appreciate the update on the meth lab issue since I did serve judiciary with a number of our colleagues here last session in that grueling work. But I think it's important that we clarify that the focus of the meth work was to help eradicate the meth labs here in Portland. We still have in Oregon, and we still have a significant road to travel in regard to meth trafficking. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, you're exactly correct. The idea of regulating pseudoephedrine in Oregon was to get rid of meth labs, not meth. However, we do have some recent good news, which you probably heard about. Another part of our plan, of course, was to control the international supply of pseudoephedrine, and we got Congress to enact Subtitle B of the Combat Meth Epidemic Act, and the United Nations entered a resolution, and we've done some progressive things that have, in effect, reduced the purity and increased the price of methamphetamine over the last 6 months. So some of our international controls to address the supply of meth itself have worked provisionally for a while, and we're hoping that the international will and commitment to continue that progress continues. But you are exactly correct. We got rid of pseudoephedrine in Oregon to get rid of meth labs, and it's done an amazing job.
Any further questions? Yeah, committee members, this would say the experience with local meth labs is one of those really wonderful experiences in public policy. They don't come along so often where you take action, and the last session of legislature with leadership within this committee, and particularly our chair, Representative Krieger, brought forward a package of bills that really had a change on what happens to Oregonians, and it's just one of those great experiences to be involved in and inspires many of us, and Mr. Beauvais' leadership in that process was most appreciated. There are no more questions. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2782 and open a public hearing on a work session on House Bill 2782. Any further discussion or a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee pass House Bill 2782 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2782 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Hoff.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 2782 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Krieger, the nature of this bill itself could put it on the consent calendar, but this might be a good opportunity to give the floor an update on this data about the local meth labs. So if you would carry the bill and do that, that would be terrific. Thank you. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2782. And since we still don't see Representative Lim, who is here, who's going to be coming, we understood, on House Bill 2766, we will go back to the work sessions, but I think we need Council Taylor in for that. So we'll recess for just a moment, or stand at ease for just a moment, while we get Council Taylor in for these bills. Oh, there he is. That was quick. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2124.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2124 comes to you from the Attorney General, Harvey Myers, of the Department of Justice. Clarifies that the Department of Justice Child Support Program has the same statutory authority that other state agencies have to contract with financial institutions to pay garnishment search fees on a periodic basis, instead of paying each time a garnishment is delivered to the financial institution. States of child support judgment is terminated upon the effective date of a later issued child support judgment rather than when judgment was entered. Recourse withholding income and child support matters beginning no later than the first payday unless the person responsible for withholding receives the order to withhold less than 5 days prior to the payday following receipt of the order. Chairman, as a committee, you have in front of you the Dash 1 amendments, and you also, Department of Justice was nice enough to supply us with a Hayman Gross version showing the amendments, and I believe these are to address questions that Representative Cameron had when we last had this bill before us way back on January 17th.
Council, it may be helpful for the committee to get walked through the revised language. This would be helpful to me, and either you could do that, or if there was somebody from the Department of Justice to do that.
Chairman of the committee, I can do it. But, go to page 3 of the bill, section 4, if you see the engrossed version. It says in page 3, deletes lines 1 through 4, and insert the first pay period occurring 5 days after the date of the order to withhold. So that would be added to the end. So it reads, the withholder shall start withholding no later than the first payday period occurring 5 days after the date of the order to withhold. However, if one of the date the employer receives the order, the employer has already calculated the payroll for that pay period and has prepared that this paycheck or submitted a deposit for that payroll, the employer shall start withholding no later than the second pay period occurring after the date of the order to withhold.
So, in other words, committee, what it's doing then is, for those employers that have a fairly long lag time between when they run their payroll and when they actually deliver the paycheck, they can't be caught in a situation where they've already run the payroll and have to go back and redo it because they get an order to withhold in. Are there any questions for counsel or anyone else about the Dash 1 amendments or the bill generally?
Yeah, I believe I was the one that kind of had a lot of the questions and worked with him on the amendments, and these amendments make it real clear and easy to follow for employers and won't trap an employer. Mm-hmm. So it's a good job.
Very good. Do I hear a motion on the Dash 1 amendments?
Mr. Chair, I'll move Dash 1 amendments to 2124 be adopted.
Representative Cameron has moved the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2124. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The Dash 1 amendments are in the bill. We have a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2124 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2124 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of that motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Ford.
Aye.
Representative
Cox. Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reese.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 2124 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. And Representative Cameron, since you've taken an interest in the bill, would you carry that on the floor?
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Close the work session on House Bill 2124 and open the work session on House Bill 2311. Council Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2311 comes to you from the whole series of people that they filed across the House Interim Judiciary Committee, the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, Oregon Collectors Association, Judicial Department, Oregon Justice of Peace Association, Oregon Municipal Judges Association. Eliminates court facilities and local court facilities accounts, sets the interest and judgment and statutory rate set forth in ORS 82.010 of 9% per annum, allows the state court administrator to waive interest for purposes administering collection of judgments from the state courts, allows the municipal court judge and justice of peace court to do the same, requires payments to be paid first to principal then interest, allows money collected as interest in state court to be used to pay costs of collection and the monies left over to be paid to the criminal injuries justice compensation account, allows monies collected as interest in local courts to be used to pay costs of collections and then additional monies left over to be paid to the local governments. You have, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, two sets of amendments in front of you. The Dash 1 amendments address an issue that you raised, and it basically says that criminal judgments bearing interest at the rate set forth in ORS 82.010 for a period of 20 years and after that judgment is entered. Criminal judgments do not bear interest after this 20-year period. So for 20 years, it would be interest at, I believe, 9%, and then no interest thereafter. And then the second amendment, and this came from Mr. Marquis, and this basically says judgments bear interest. Actually, that's the same one. Chair members of the committee, the Dash 2 amendments basically make this applicable only to the state court system and not to municipal and justice and peace court system. And the intent here, Mr. Chair members of the committee, is that local judges, meaning county judges and justice of the peace judges, those court systems would have the option of making it applicable to principal first, or in keeping with the current practice by common law interest first. And I believe Mr. Marquis, when he spoke to me about it, talked about the difficulty these small jurisdictions may have of changing the programs over. But I think it would be best that he address the issue.
Okay. Why don't we bring Mr. Marquis forward? And is there anybody from the Judicial Department here that would be... why don't you come forward as well, just so we can make sure that we're settled on this, the Dash 2 amendments. Mr. Marquis, do you have anything to add to what Council Taylor said about the Dash 2 amendments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association, and I did ask to have this amendment drafted. I We had spoken about this earlier. The change in the bill would require that all payments received would have to be posted to principal first. That is not the normal accepted accounting practice, as you probably know, when you make your payments on your house or anything else, they post the interest first. It is somewhat of an advantage to the consumer to do so, and we have no problem with the state court system doing that, which I believe was a request of the victims assistance folks, where this money would be going. But for those local jurisdictions, there are all kinds of agreements in place with collection agencies who do the collections for them, and those arrangements include sharing in the interest between the collection agency and the jurisdiction, justice court or municipal court. We just wanted to leave that discretion with them because those agreements are all over the map, and it would be troublesome, I think, for them to all go back and try to change their programs and their, the way they do business. So we'd like to leave that discretion with the local jurisdictions.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Marquis? Any comments from the Judicial Department? Any concerns about the Dash 2 amendments?
Chair McPherson, for the record, I'm Sarah Gates, Deputy State Court Administrator with the Judicial Department. We have no issue with the amendments.
Okay. Any other questions for either of the, these individuals? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question on the staff measure summary. The last sentence under background, however, the interest on these judgments has never generated sufficient enough revenue to cover operating expenses of the accounts. I could you clarify that for me a little bit?
Chair, Representative Flores, this bill was first enacted, I think, about 5 or 6 years ago. Its intent was to generate funds for court improvements and court construction. You heard another bill last week. We will hear it again soon on the issue of relating to courts and their conditions. I think you may remember Paul Snyder testifying on this the last time the bill was up. Because of court computer programs and the difficulty of transferring monies in the collection process, what we have is a system where the expenses in running the system are greater than the interest that is earned that would otherwise go to courts. And what has happened, I think in 2003, this whole system was put on hold to give the chance for the accounting system, the computer system, to catch up. It has not. In the time that this is on, theoretically, this program would have cost a lot more to operate than it would have generated in income. But its intent is designed to address the issue that the state and the counties have because they're tied at the hip on this issue, as we've heard, as it relates to courthouses, to generate income for that program. It's not doing so and cannot do so.
I guess, thank you, Mr. Taylor. I guess my question is that according to the explanation of the problems that we had in our file and the tables that we showed that payments to the OJD, principal only, in the amount of $20,640,000, interest on that is not enough to not generating enough revenue to cover the operating expenses. So what would be the interest on $20 million and we're not being able to cover. So I'm obviously missing something here, so that's why I'm confused.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Flores, I guess that would be best addressed to the courts. This is the representation that was made in 2003 to us concerning why they asked for an extension at that time and holding this program in advance. That's the testimony I believe we received back on March 2nd on, I guess they would be better able to address it than I can.
Well, I guess that's what I get for missing that March 2nd meeting.
But Sarah Gates is here.
Let's actually have Ms. Gates comment on this. It has been it's been striking to me to see what a difficult challenge it has been for the Judicial Department to calculate interest, which many other organizations calculate. I mean, they regulate. You get your telephone bill, your power bill, whatever. I mean, there's a calculation of interest that is all programmed out, and so for some of us, it's been a struggle to understand why it has been so difficult for the Judicial Department to calculate interest on criminal fines. So if you could remind us why that is.
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, I'd love to.
They're attorneys.
It's Monday. Let's be enthusiastic here. Okay?
All right.
And as you may or may not be aware, our case and financial management system was written back in the 80s. It's a COBOL-based system that is very difficult to modify. At this point, it cannot comply with the statute and calculate interest going to multiple places. So we have not been calculating interest at all on these judgments because we cannot do it. The way the bill is making changes, it will have all interest that is calculated by the private collection firms, and the Department of Revenue will go to one place. It will go to the crime victim's account. The way the statute's written right now, it would go partially, you'd have up to calculate interest on this piece, and it would go over here, and another on compensatory fines would go over here. We cannot do that. The other piece is, when you calculate interest, if you're doing it on a frequent basis like you would in a checking account or something like that, your balance is changing constantly. So as you tell somebody, you owe me $300, and they come to pay the $300, well, all of a sudden the number's changed because interest has been calculated. So we don't have a system that can even provide that information, let alone calculate the interest, but provide that information to those who need to pay us. Does that answer your question?
That's helpful. Okay, thank you.
We are working on system improvements that will allow us to comply with these laws in the future.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. I just have to go farther. I don't know what COBOL is. I find it unimaginable that a system can't be worked out with all the technology and the bright people we have in this world today. And what can we do to help solve what seems to be a CPA's delight to figure out?
Chair McPherson, Representative Comp, I share your curiousness and frustration.
Yes.
When I came here a year ago, I was rather unpleasantly surprised at the state of our case financial system. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, I could not believe it until I spent more time looking at it. It's incredibly complicated to modify and very expensive and dangerous because it's, I just think about Band-Aids on Band-Aids on Band-Aids. It's all interrelated, and when you touch one piece of the system, it breaks four or five things other places. We have just launched on an initiative called eCourt that will be replacing these systems in the next 5 years. Clearly, we will be putting in a modern financial piece to that system. So we will be addressing it as rapidly as possible, but we haven't had the funding to replace these systems.
Follow up?
You may.
So am I to make the conclusion, and I don't use the word assumption, that you have a strategic plan to correct this problem?
Chair McPherson, Representative Comp, absolutely.
And I think in fairness to the Judicial Department, part of the challenge has been that we as policymakers have presented them with a rather complex set of requirements, and part of House Bill 2311 is to simplify those. And I have to say, I am one of those who added a layer of complication a couple of years ago because they were previously going to be calculating interest at a flat 9%, which didn't seem right to me for 50-year judgments for restitution. So that was when this higher rate of 12.5% followed by a lower 4% got put into the statutes, which has never been implemented, and as it turns out, just isn't worth the complication. And so our solution of the same flat 9% on those judgments for the first 20 years and then going to 0% is the simpler solution. So we as policymakers need to give them an easier set of requirements.
Back to the bill, Chair McPherson. Am I to read that we need both the dash 2 and the dash 1s?
Yes, those are independent amendments, and one of them is the dash 2 amendments accomplish the purpose that Mr. Marquis was describing, that is to carve out the justice and municipal courts, and the dash 1 amendments make the change to go to 0% after 20 years on the long-term judgments, but essentially it's restitution judgments.
Thanks for the clarification.
Okay, any further questions for either Ms. Gates or Mr. Marquis?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
I just want to clarify one more time that we're going to eliminate the court facilities and local court facilities account. Can you explain how that relates to the bill we heard last week establishing a new court capital account? I just want to make sure that I get the connection here of these two accounts versus that account.
Ms. Gates, are you in a position to explain that change, or shall I take a swing at it?
We can want to flip a coin just to see who can do it. I'll try.
Okay.
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, these two pieces of legislation are independent, and because the money will no longer be flowing into the court facilities account in this bill, it needs to eliminate that account. The other bill you're referring to, House Bill 2857, is creating a different court facilities account. We will have a housekeeping amendment to that bill as well to eliminate the one you're referring to. It's kind of, these bills are separate bills, so we need to clean up the statutes in this bill, and we'll make sure that 2857 adjusts as necessary.
Yeah, just to follow up. I understand they're different bills, but the court eliminates court facilities and local court facilities accounts. Were those accounts set up for construction and maintenance of court facilities as the other bill that we're talking about is for court facilities and maintenance? So that this is going to eliminate a couple of accounts. The other one's going to establish account basically that would for the same purposes. Is that, I just want to be clear on that. Is that correct?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I'm not an expert on these account on the law side of how those accounts are established, but that's my understanding. And if the chair or council has a better explanation, please.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Ms. Parkey.
The court facilities accounts that were established some years ago have never really been used. They were established for capital construction, and the main source of revenue to those accounts would have been interest on criminal judgments. The way in which the law was prescribed that the interest was to be dispersed was through this matrix of several different accounts. It was very complicated and impossible not only for the judicial department's computer system to work out, but the clerks and everybody else, they couldn't do it. The solution to that problem lies in finding one place to put the money, and so we tried to accomplish that. I sat on a work group with Sarah and others, and we worked around a table of trying to figure out what to do about that. The agreement was to send the money to this crime victims assistance account. As you just heard from Ms. Gates, 5 years before you're going to see any money anyway, so it may be kind of a moot question at this point. But from a policy perspective, you are eliminating the interest on criminal judgments accruing to those capital construction accounts. At some point in the future, I think, as we have talked through the other bill, 2857, we had another task force that met that talked about where are we going to get the money to build new courthouses and maintain the ones that we have. It is an ongoing problem, and I testified the other day about that, and there are some disagreements about where the money ought to come from, and some of us think down the road that we ought to be looking at this money for that. Although this money may be a drop in the bucket compared to what we need. So I think there'll need to be a combination of funding mechanisms that we look at for that. And I think that people are now looking at trying to get together during this interim period to really figure out what those funding mechanisms need to be. Hope that answers your question.
Any further questions? If not, then thank you, Mr. Markey and Ms. Gates. So, committee, we have the dash one and dash two amendments in front of us, which operate are independent of each other, but I think both address different issues that have come up in the discussion of the bill. Do we have a motion on the amendments to House Bill 2311?
Mr. Chair, I move that we include Amendment 1 and 2 into 2311.
Representative Wisnett has moved the dash 1 and dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2311. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Then the dash 1 and dash 2 amendments are in the bill. Do I hear a motion on House Bill 2311 as amended?
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee recommend to the floor, or pass to the floor of a due pass recommendation, House Bill 2311 as amended.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2311 as amended by the dash 1 and dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Kopp.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye.
House Bill 2311, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Because I have paid closer attention probably to these interest calculating matters, I will plan to carry that on the floor myself. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2311 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2766.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2766 relates to fines for underage alcohol offenses. ORS 471.430 makes it a Class B violation for underage persons to attempt to purchase, to acquire, or to be in possession of alcohol. It is also a Class B violation to attempt to enter licensed premises where underage persons are not allowed. A Class B violation carries a maximum fine of $360. House Bill 2766 amends ORS 471.430 by raising fine for these offenses. Instead of a Class B violation, the offense now carries a mandatory minimum fine of $350 for the first offense and a mandatory minimum fine of $1,000 for any subsequent offense.
Okay. And, Representative Lim, this is your bill, so please come and explain it to us.
Thank you very much.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, and for the record, my name is John Lim, state representative from District 50, which is Gresham area. Just want to thank you, the Chair McPherson and members of the committee, the hearing House Bill 2766. This is a very important bill, and I used to own the grocery store long time ago. And also, as you know, many of the minorities, such as Koreans and Chinese and Vietnamese, they own mom and pop grocery stores. And maybe about 60-70% even more, the small grocery mom and pop stores owned by the minority members, especially the Korean American, even several days ago. One of the Korean family has been a victim of this Belmont store, as you all know. This has been a continual problem. And when many of them complained that while they were penalized $350 and plus from the OLCC administration rule, penalizing them additional $1,650 for the owner of the establishment, but at the same time when the minor wants to buy and violate it, and then it's the slap on the wrist, which is $350, and then most of the time counties reduce of that fine. So it is a lopsided justice in our society. And I don't think my bill, House Bill 2766, will cure all of that problem. At least the passage of this bill will give them the strong message. When you are penalized, you will be have a penalty at $350 up to, and the second time they have to pay $1,000. So they will think twice when they on the minors on the 21 and going into the convenience store to try to buy it. They might consider, oh, when I make a mistake, when I get caught, I might get $350 first time, and second time it will be $1,000. I'm sure you do have all the letters from the Hardy Mai, Attorney General. I just happen to have this copy this morning, and if I may, Mr. Chair, I'd like to read a quote from the first paragraph of the Surgeon General's forward note on this alcohol issue. Alcohol is the most widely used substance of abuse among America youth. Higher percentage of young people between the ages of 12 and 20 use alcohol than use tobacco and illicit drugs. Physical consequences of the underage alcohol use range from medical problem to death by alcohol poisoning, and alcohol plays a significant role in risky sexual behavior, physical and sexual assault, various type of injuries, and suicide. Underage drinking also creates secondary effects for others, drinkers and non-drinkers alike, including car crash from drunk driving, and put every child at risk. Underage alcohol consumption is a major societal problem with enormous health and safety consequences, and will demand the national attention and the committed effort to solve. As you know, that the alcohol problem for the teenagers is a big problem in our society, and continue to grow. Even 10, 12, 13, and up to the 21 years old, they experience alcohol, and 20% of them has a severe drinking and a drunk problem in the past. This is a well-known fact. And I'm hoping that the passage of House Bill 2766, we could send a strong message. Even the passage of this bill, this is not even par with the store owner. At least with this message, we might be able to address some of the concerns we have. Hopefully, with this bill, we might be able to reduce that the consumption of the alcohol by the minors.
Any questions for Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lim. We've heard a lot of bills in this committee on underage drinking and those issues, and I appreciate the seriousness of that issue. I wonder if there was a reason why you took the approach of instead of changing the class of violations, of setting a mandatory minimum. I just wonder how you arrived at this approach to this issue rather than changing what class violation it was.
Can you answer that? Can I call my staff?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, Seth Hatmaker, Representative John Lim's Chief of Staff. Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici. The intent of the bill was to bring the penalty that the minor receives up to par or equal with what an establishment receives, kind of a punitive equity, if you will. Now, as we talked to OLCC, evidently, I mean, the establishment's still going to receive a bit more because they're going to have an OLCC administrative, what they call that, administrative violation, which, you know, I take it the minor cannot receive because I take it the minor, I mean, minors don't have to sort of go through the OLCC. The establishment does. So the reason for this punishment is that's what establishments pay. Now, there is always, I guess there's just always going to kind of be a bit of difference because there's also the OLCC to have to, there to deal with establishments with liquor license. And then also when you're talking about restaurants and taverns, there again, there's still going to be, it's not going to be a perfect equality in that, you know, a minor receives what the establishment's going to receive because with the on-premise businesses like restaurants, taverns, servers get fined as well. So I hope that kind of answers, you know, what the intent behind it was.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to see exactly even par the seller and buyer when they violated the same inequality, but at this time it's not. Maybe we can try as it is. In the future, we might make it better if it doesn't work.
Further questions?
More of a comment, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lim, for bringing this. I had a manager of a Bi-Mart store, which is a, you know, bigger than a mom and pop, mm-hmm. come to me and say, why do we suffer so much if somebody gets out, you know, buys liquor, an underage person gets liquor, we really get hammered, and nothing happens to the person who's attempting or buying. Very little happens, and I think this will address that. A $350 fine, it'll take a few people getting fined or several before the word really gets out, but I think this might make a difference. The store in a grocery store, if a clerk sells, a lot of times they'll lose their job if they, you know, mistakenly sell and if they're just sloppy or don't read the license right. And so the sellers are receiving a really hard punishment, which is fine if they're intentionally doing that. I don't have an objection to them really getting hammered if they're selling to kids. But this will help hopefully deter a lot of younger people from trying to buy and putting everybody in jeopardy. And then the other thing that the paragraph Representative Lim read does make a lot of sense from the Surgeon General's office. People who start drinking when they're 12 and 13 and 14 are the ones who are really get addicted to the alcohol, and they're the ones at the AA meetings later on that are trying to get their lives salvaged after really ruining a lot of things. So I think this is a very good step in the right direction.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lim, thank you for bringing the bill forward. I want to point out another thing this bill does, which was a concern of mine earlier in the session that we talked about, is that if a minor attempts to gain entrance into a minor posted area using fake ID, this has some teeth in it, at least $350. And the research that I've been getting back is, yeah, we're working on it, and this actually has some teeth in it. So I'm very excited to see this come forward and supportive of your bill. Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cameron, that's one of the problems I'm having with this bill, though, is that a lot of restaurants are posted, and I have actually gone in there with an underage minor to eat in the bar so I can watch TV or something. And I'm not sure that, you know, if they're trying to get into a place that's a nightclub or something like that, but most bars in this town have they're only 21 years old, and a lot of people from out of state wouldn't know that. Isn't that correct? Help me with that. I don't understand.
If the light's red, you stop.
Yeah.
If it says minors not posted, they can't be in there. My point is that if you go to these, and I wasn't talking about your particular situation.
No, but
I'm talking about nightclubs, for example, when there's a line out the door and people are using fake IDs, and what happens is the IDs get confiscated. If we had something like this, a police officer could write a ticket that kid's going to pay $350, no questions asked. It's not going to be reduced. And your situation, I don't know about that. But if it says minors posted, it's a red light and they can't be in there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
I want to ask a question of Counsel Stanford. This under this bill, the first conviction and second or subsequent convictions is separated out. What happens now? Because it's my understanding that right now there's a maximum fine of $360, which according to Representative Lim and seems to be a bit anecdotal, but it, now those aren't imposed and they're reduced too often. But what happens now on second or subsequent convictions?
Representative Bonamici, my experience, again, is limited to Multnomah County practice, and I'll say the cases that I've seen are cases it would always involve a person 18, 19, or 20 picking up an MIP, because those are the persons that would be eligible for the community court program as opposed to juvenile programs. I don't think, I'm just trying to think what happens. I think I've only seen one. The short answer is I don't know, and I don't know that there's anything beyond what is typical in a community court Multnomah County case, which is first-time offender goes to trauma nurses talk tough program. They have to attend, and they're usually either given a fine or 16 hours of community service is generally what happens. On the second offense, I've only seen it once, and it was there was no trauma nurses talk tough class. It was more community service. That's the only time I can think of. So it's not a good answer to your question.
Thank you.
I have a question about just the wording of the bill, and I'm not sure, Representative Lim, whether you're obviously you probably submitted an idea and legislative council drafted it up with this language, but there is the phrasing is the court shall impose at least a mandatory minimum sentence as follows, and then all that follows are two fines. And I don't generally, in a sort of my understanding, is that a sentence is something is incarceration or it's community service, but I think of a fine as being something that's different from a sentence. And I don't know if you have any comments on that or not.
Well, Mr. Chair and the members, I'm not a lawyer, but I only thought that the 1,000 is a strong enough the deterrent. And so in the community service, they might be able to do it, and plus others, but the monetary penalty might be the best way for the minors. Make sure they stay away. In case if they do, they are going to be penalized up to $350, and a second time, it's just $1,000. I think that that's a strong message and a strong deterrent.
Okay, Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. Just looking more closely at the question of the proper terminology, where it's we're not talking about a crime, we're talking about a violation. Looking at ORS 153.018, it's discussing violations generally, and it talks about schedule of penalties. The penalty for committing a violation is a fine. The law creating a violation may impose other penalties in addition to a fine, but may not impose a term of imprisonment. But then you turn to subsection 2, and it actually uses the phrase, except as provided in this section, a sentence to pay a fine for a violation shall be a sentence to pay an amount not exceeding, and then it lists the amounts. Okay. So it appears that sentence works. Thank you.
Okay. Any Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have another question since the council has the book open. Can something just be a violation without being in a class, or does it have to be in a class? It could just be a general violation.
Representative Bonamici, yes, it can be. There are you've got your class A, B, C, and D, and then you have there's an additional. I'm seeing if it's listed in here. There's an additional category for sub E here. The amount otherwise established by law for any specific fine violation. There are a number of violations that are out there. That there is, it's not classified, it's just you pay this amount. The one that springs to mind first and foremost is the refusal to submit to a breath test. It is a mandatory, it's a $1,000 fine, it's unclassified.
Thank you.
Representative Lim is the only witness signed up for today, and committee, as you may recall, we had a package of bills. There were 9 bills that were brought to us by the Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force. And this concept of stiffening the penalties for attempts to purchase was not among those proposals. So it would be the Chair's intention not to move this to work session today, but to get input as to what
consideration there may have been to this concept from that group, which was quite recently addressed the same set of concerns, to find out how this coordinates with their recommendations and why they might not have pursued this idea among the proposals they brought forward to us. So on that basis, I will now, and thank you, Representative Lim, for bringing this to us. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2766. Members, that concludes our agenda for today. To give you a heads up about our schedule a week from today, we will not be holding a morning meeting of the Judiciary Committee on Monday the 19th. Instead, we will hold an afternoon meeting up in the metro area at Aloha High School from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m., and it's going to be a hearing on Internet predators, which is an issue that's been getting quite a bit of attention of late. And for those of you who have afternoon committee schedules where you can't be away from the building, of course, that would excuse you, but I'm hoping 2 to 5 p.m. In Aloha High School. So I'm hoping that for those who live in or near the metro area, that could be a on the way home sort of thing, so it would fit into people's schedules. But that was a time that worked well for the school to have us come to that kind of setting. So that's a little roadmap for the future. Thank you for your participation today. We are adjourned.